This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Hello, my name's Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 18th of February 2009, I introduced the seventh session of the General Theory Reading Group with a talk on the theme Why Wage Cuts Will Not Create Jobs. The talk is based on Book 5 of the General Theory and the corresponding Chapter 5 in my own book, The Economics of Keynes, a new guide to the General Theory, published by Edward Elgar. You can also download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening. Okay, so tonight I want to introduce Book 5. The General Theory, under the general theme, Why Wage Cuts Will Not Create Jobs. There's more to Book 5 than that, but the classical prescription of wage cuts as the remedy for unemployment was perhaps the key policy against which Keynes had fought throughout the 1920s and 30s, and against which the general theory was addressed. Furthermore, if you can cast your mind back all the way to session two, you will recall that this issue divides the two rival theories of employment. In classical theory, which still dominates economics today, as we know, employment is determined in the labour market. In Keynes's theory, employment is determined in general by demand, and the conditions under which workers are prepared to supply labour are relevant to aggregate employment only in the special, limiting case of full employment. Furthermore, while in the classical theory real wages determine employment, in the general theory employment determines real wages. So the causality is reversed. And the other key and related doctrine against which Book 5 is addressed is the quantity theory of money, or the theory of money and prices, as it was also known in Keynes's day, by contrast with the theory of, shall we say, relative value and distribution. Keynes sought to generalise the quantity theory, as he had done the theory of value. There's an important theoretical connection between the wage cut prescription and the quantity theory, namely in the standard but illicit assumption that employers and workers as a whole can determine the general level of real wages by bargaining. Since we observe bargains only in money wages, the necessary implicit assumption of classical theory is that given perfect competition and flexible prices, the general price level is determined independently by the quantity of money.
By the quantity of money.
As we shall see, this assumption in turn depends on the assumption of full employment, thus creating a circular argument so far as employment is concerned, or at least an argument that contains no room for involuntary unemployment through deficient demand. Indeed, the assumption of full, or at any rate fixed, employment is the necessary foundation of the classical conception of equilibrium, as we discussed all the way back in session one. But before we tackle these policy-oriented questions, we need to put some finishing touches on our theoretical apparatus. Hard work ahead. In session 5, I referred to the model of aggregate demand as an elegant static equilibrium construction. We now have to complete the model of effective demand as a whole by returning to the supply side and finishing the job that was started in chapter 3 of the GT. And these final steps are taken in GT chapters 18 and 20. Now, the title of chapter 20 is The Employment Function, which I referred to in session two as the backbone of the general theory. Written as N star equals F D star, although Keynes writes it without the stars because he's a good Marshallian, this relates the level of aggregate employment to the level of effective demand measured in wage units, real effective demand, if you like. The employment function is implicit in the conditions of competitive equilibrium that determine expected, think forward, prices in each individual industry, given the state of the three independent psychological variables, the propensity to consume and the two schedules of the marginal efficiency of capital and of liquidity preference, together with the quantity of money measured in wage units and the physical conditions of supply represented by the aggregate supply function. Since the conditions of physical supply are given and all the money variables are measured in wage units, the employment function in effect maps changes in the psychological independent variables, or changes in the supply of real money balances, to use a modern phrase, onto changes in the level of employment. So ultimately, it also maps changes in the state of expectation onto the level of employment. There is a great deal I could say about the employment function, which would take us too deep into the detail. But let me briefly make three points about it. First of all, the employment function F is not simply the aggregate supply function ZW in disguise. Although Keynes writes on page 280 that it, quote, it only differs from the aggregate supply function in that it is, in effect, its inverse function, unquote, he later goes on to qualify this as, quote, no better than a first approximation if we admit that there is more than one way in which an increase in income can be spent, unquote. The underlying point is that the employment function can be uniquely defined because it takes into account the pattern of demand as well as the conditions of supply. While strictly, the aggregate supply function for industry as a whole cannot be so defined. ZW depends on the composition as well as the level of employment, and therefore, it can have more than one value for any given level of aggregate employment. ZW, of course, is the aggregate supply price, measured in wage units. It remains true that at the point of effective demand, the actual ZW is the inverse function of the actual F. But I think this point has been missed, largely because of the insistence by readers of treating output as homogeneous throughout the general theory, so that there would, in that case, only be one value of ZW for each N. And as we shall see later today, tonight, Keynes gives them some excuse by treating aggregate output as homogeneous in the later parts of chapters 20 and 21, for the specific purpose of constructing his generalised quantity theory, or generalised statement of the quantity theory. But this is unfortunate if it leads to a confusion of the special with the general case. My second point is that the employment function truly represents the macro foundation of microeconomics. The Marshallian supply curves of individual industries and firms are no more independent of the volume of output and employment of industry as a whole than are the individual industry demand curves. Both supply and demand curves depend on aggregate employment and output. This was Sraffa's point in 1926. So Keynes's principle of effective demand brings determinacy to the Marshallian system below full employment. As in the limiting classical case, Keynes's system equilibrium, as I've called it, requires simultaneous solution of production possibilities and household preferences and what have you. But these are circumscribed by the shifting state of expectation rather than by the classical parameters of endowment, technology, preferences alone. Once the relationship between the levels of aggregate expected income and employment is established as a matter of competitive equilibrium at the system level, the individual employment functions for each industry follow directly. And we can go on then to analyse each firm and industry in isolation. As Keynes puts it, if we suppose the volume of output to be given, that is, to be determined by forces outside the classical scheme of thought, then there is no objection to be raised against the classical analysis of the manner in which private self-interest will determine what in particular is produced, in what proportions the factors of production will be combined to produce it, and how the value of the final product will be distributed between them. So he's a real neoclassical, really. I think basically he sought not to replace the Marshallian theory of value, but to bring it to perfection. My third and final point about the employment function is that its objective definition requires the assumption of perfect competition, i.e. price-taking, in the markets for current output, as well as for existing capital assets. I explained in session one what Keynes understood by perfect or pure or free competition and how this is consistent with the Marshallian degree of competition he takes as given in chapter 18. Thus I differ from most post-Keynesian writers on this point. Indeed, some take the polar opposite view from me, that the general theory requires the assumption of imperfect competition, while most think the core of the general theory is consistent with either perfect or imperfect competition in the sense of Joan Robinson. But Keynes appears to me to have recognised that the theory of monopolistic competition, as I prefer to call it, is an exercise in partial, not aggregate analysis, essentially an extension of classical theory. And that an aggregate theory can be based on monopolistic competition only if you're prepared to follow Kolesky and take the markup or markups as exogenous. And of course, many post-Keynesians have done just that. But I think they've done so at the cost of abandoning Keynes's claim to offer a fundamental critique of classical competitive equilibrium analysis on its own ground. So with the definition of the employment function, the equilibrium model of effective demand is complete and is summarised without the detailed qualifications I've burdened you with, which come from GT chapter 20, in GT chapter 18. And I'm sure that by now you understand that Keynes's model is far more complex and sophisticated than is represented by the Keynesian cross, the ISLM model, or even the post-Keynesian ZD model. Furthermore, even this model is not the end of the story, and most of Book 5 and 6 move beyond the equilibrium model or subsystem of the general theory. Unlike the classical model, Keynes's has independent variables as well as parameters. Independent variables which are beyond the reach of equilibrium analysis. Although Keynes's model, subsystem, is deterministic, as all equilibrium models must be, it is not self-sufficient and closed in the sense that the parameters alone determine the outcome. Rather, as I said earlier, it must be understood as a mapping of the independent variables onto the dependent variables, i.e. employment and income. The model's open-ended, driven ultimately in the short term by those changing views about the future, which cannot be reduced to a set of parameters or directly expressed numerically. Nevertheless, this does not rule out attempts to explain without invoking equilibrium the tendencies of the independent variables over time, in terms consistent with historical observations. And this is precisely what Keynes sets out to do in the rest of books 5 and 6. I think Keynes strikes the right balance between what can and what cannot usefully be done with the classical tools of equilibrium analysis. So book 5 is therefore for the most part of a different character to the earlier books. Chapter 19 considers, mainly, the causal link running from money wages via the quantity of money to employment. Chapter 20 develops the causal link in the opposite direction, from employment to prices and money wages. While chapter 21 considers the resultant relationship between the quantity of money and the levels of employment, money wages and prices. However, in contrast to the dependent variables of the little subsystem, the money wage and the closely related price level are not equilibrium values held continuously in a stable position by competitive forces. We've moved outside the equilibrium model for the first time, you might say. And perhaps it's because the money wage is outside the equilibrium model that the myth has developed that Keynes assumes rigid money wages, confusing exogeneity with rigidity. As I pointed out in session one, the money wage and other factor prices, which together make up his cost unit, cannot clear markets in a monetary economy. And Keynes's equilibrium is not defined by clearing factor markets. The money wage is not beyond explanation, but it's not an equilibrium value. And I think this might be why GT Book 5 is rarely cited by classical economists, even those who perhaps cite the earlier chapters, like Chapter 18 or Chapter 10 on the multiplier. And why, indeed, the modern so-called ADAS model attempts to force the quantity of real balances in the money wage back inside a closed equilibrium system in a well-behaved sort of manner. Now, as I stated at the outset, the primary policy target of the general theory was the classical prescription that money wage reductions would reduce unemployment. In GT Chapter 2, Keynes attacked the classical theory of employment on two grounds. First, its implausible prediction of the withdrawal of unemployed labour in response to a rise in prices. And secondly, its logical inconsistency in asserting that money wages and real wages are interchangeable concepts. After 16 chapters of careful argument, of which you have had a taste, in presenting his new theory of employment based on the principle of effective demand, in GT Chapter 19, Keynes is at last ready to return to the question of money wages. And in large part, his new theory is itself the answer to the question, because his money variables can all be measured in wage units without affecting their theoretical relationships. So, in an immediate sense, he has already shown that the money wage has no direct influence on aggregate employment. And it's surprising, really, that this point is not often made. Money wage cuts can only increase employment if they increase effective demand. And there can be no direct connection between money wages and effective demand measured in wage units. Nevertheless, given the importance of the wage cut prescription in classical thought, Keynes takes pains to identify the indirect repercussions of a change in money wages via their influence on the independent variables of his equilibrium subsystem, notably the quantity of money expressed in wage units. And he identifies no less than 7 possible channels of indirect influence, before concluding that the only one that is remotely credible for policy purposes is through real balances, the so-called Keynes effect. By assuming that the nominal quantity of money is exogenous, he bends over backwards to accommodate the classical position, noting that, I quote, "if the quantity of money is itself a function of the wage and price level, there is indeed nothing to hope for in this direction," and therefore actually anticipating the post-Keynesian endogenous money critique, of which we've heard a great deal. He notes that a policy of wage cuts becomes, in pure theory, equivalent to an expansive monetary policy, and is subject to at least the same limitations and constraints, in particular the risk to confidence. And furthermore, in practice, a policy of wage cuts also brings with it additional problems of enforcement, distributive justice, debt deflation, and depression of the state of long-term expectation. As Keynes puts it, only an inexperienced person would prefer wage cuts to monetary expansion. I won't discuss Keynes's critique of Pigou in the appendix to chapter 19, since this was addressed in detail by Michael Ambrosi in this seminar on the 22nd of October last term. And you can, of course, listen to the podcast if you missed it. But something that's missing from the general theory is a direct influence of an increase in real balances on the level of consumption, the so-called Pigou effect. Call that, I think, after an article by Pigou written some time after the general theory. To some extent, I covered this in sessions 5 and 6, when I discussed Keynes's hierarchy of liquidity and his deliberate separation of decisions to consume from decisions as to the form in which to hold wealth. I don't think anyone takes the Pigou effect as of serious practical significance, given the catastrophic consequence of debt deflation. Yet, ironically, it is a theoretical mainstay of the modern claim that in the long run, flexible prices will lead to full employment. In terms of our theoretical discussion, the Pigou effect represents a postulated relationship between 3 of the independent variables of Keynes's system: consumption function, quantity of money, and the wage unit. And there is a fundamental, what you might call, dimensional problem here, in that the principle of effective demand relates to the daily short period, the instantaneous short period, as I put it. And the Pigou effect, if it exists, relates to the long term. The Pigou effect simply doesn't fit into Keynes's equilibrium model, since variables which adjust in the long term cannot possibly bring about equilibrium in the short period. If the Pigou effect were in fact a short period phenomenon, we would experience the violent instability of the price level and the shattering of confidence, which are anything but conducive to increased employment, as Keynes notes. If the Pigou effect is to be understood as a long-term phenomenon, well, any and all observed values of employment can be justified as examples of temporary disequilibrium, so that the concept of equilibrium vanishes into the sphere of Platonic ideas and becomes empty of scientific content. So let's now turn with Keynes to the other pillar of the doctrine that wage cuts create jobs, the quantity theory of money. Although you will have realised from past talks that I am very reluctant to attribute textual difficulties to Keynes's drafting rather than my own lack of understanding, I fear that in certain respects Keynes's attempt to generalise the quantity theory, to integrate it with a theory of value, was not quite as successful as his generalisation of a theory of employment. Partly this is because his major mathematical error in drafting the general theory appears in the section on pages 305 to 6, where he offers a formal definition of what we might call the money stock elasticity of the price level, E, which replaces the classical quantity equation. And from that perspective is the theoretical climax of his work. In terms of public relations, the error is compounded by his statement that he doesn't himself attribute much value to manipulations of this kind, and I think that must have contributed to his image in some quarters as a rather cavalier theorist.
A lousy one.
That point aside, I think a more substantial problem was raised by Hugh Townsend, when he pointed out that the prices of which the price level is composed are not the aggregate supply prices embodied in effective demand, because they differ by the marginal user cost. For the purposes of the formal algebra, the prices to which Keynes refers on pages 283 to 6 and 304 to 6 should all strictly be read as marginal proceeds. And the references to prime cost on page 283 should read factor cost. And as Keynes admits in his reply to Townsend, he has, I quote, got bogged in an attempt to bring my own terms into rather closer conformity with the algebra of others, probably Pigou, than the case really permits, unquote. But putting those unusual criticisms from me of Keynes to one side, it's very clear that what his motivation is. Even if the price level cannot strictly be represented as a single scalar value, P, because it's an index number, it is of great practical importance, now as it was then. If one is to make the price level a theoretical variable, you have to have a corresponding variable for aggregate output, despite all the pains Keynes has taken to avoid making his theory of employment dependent on any definition of output as homogeneous. Nevertheless, strictly, Keynes's approach to the price level is formally valid, because the chain of elasticities that lead up to his final E are all point elasticities, based on infinitesimal changes, so that the implicit weights in the indices of prices and outputs can be taken as given from a very formal mathematical point of view. So, despite all these detailed qualifications, what is the substance of his argument? In a nutshell, changes in the price level are determined under perfect competition by changes in marginal factor cost, if we take marginal user cost as given. Marginal factor cost is made up of the costs of hiring labour and capital assets. Marginal wage costs depends partly on the wage unit and partly on the scale of output, given diminishing returns. Similarly, marginal factor cost depends partly on the cost unit, which includes the wage unit, although again, the cost unit is an inexact index, and partly on the scale of output. Therefore, the price level depends on the level of employment and on the cost unit. Real prices by which I mean prices measured in wage units, rise as employment increases through diminishing returns. Employment is a function of effective demand expressed in wage units. That's the employment function. And effective demand is a function of the quantity of money, both expressed in wage units. Thus, within the equilibrium model, this little subsystem, there is a relationship between the quantity of real balances and the price level simply through diminishing returns. And Keynes emphasises that monetary expansion of this type is not inflationary, unless by inflationary you simply mean that prices are rising. An interesting remark, but you see what he means. At this point, Keynes introduces a new relationship outside the equilibrium model between employment and one of his independent variables, the wage unit. The rationale for this he takes to be fairly self-evident, although not always open to theoretical generalisation in the form of an elasticity based on a continuous mathematical function. Indeed, he makes a great deal about, he makes much of, the discontinuities in the function, which arise from bottlenecks or semi-critical points, where particular specialised resources become fully employed, so that increased demand translates into higher prices, or particular groups of workers press for higher wages. And indeed, when all labour is fully employed, increased demand must translate into higher money wages across the board, a state of true inflation, as he calls it. Mathematically, this is all written down in the corrected version as follows. I'll let you look at that. In words, the percentage change in the price level resulting from a percentage change in the money supply is a compound function of the effects of money on effective demand and of effective demand in turn on output and the wage unit. In Keynes's words, quote, ED stands for the liquidity factors which determine the demand for money in each situation. EW for the labour factors, or more strictly, the factors entering into prime cost. He always puts in that qualification, which determine the extent to which money wages are raised as employment increases. And E subscript O for the physical factors, which determine the rate of decreasing returns as more employment is applied to the existing equipment. Unquote. He then uses this expression to distinguish the quantity theory from the general case. The quantity theory assumes that E equals 1. Money and prices move 1 for 1. This can come about if ED equals 1, i.e. the demand for money is fixed in relation to income stroke effective demand, and either E naught equals 0, in other words output is fixed, or EW equals 1, in other words money wages rise to absorb in full any increase in effective demand expressed in nominal terms. The moral of the story is that, in part, that, I quote, in general, E is not unity. And it's perhaps safe to make the generalisation that on plausible assumptions relating to the real world, and excluding the case of a flight from the currency, in which ED and EW become large, E is, as a rule, less than unity, unquote. In other words, the creation of money, whether to finance spending directly or simply to reduce interest rates, need not, and in the general case of involuntary unemployment, will not be wholly inflationary. The key to inflation in Keynes's system lies in factor costs. Pure demand pull inflation, that is to say inflation of product prices, is impossible below full employment under perfect competition. And this is also the other part of the answer to our question. Why money wage cuts will not create jobs. With a theory of prices reconnected to the theory of value, it's clear that changes in the price level at any given level of employment are determined by changes in factor costs, of which labour cost is a large part, so that a reduction in money wages cannot reduce real wages, except to the extent that other factor costs, for example, building rents, are fixed in money terms. Money wages and the price level are not independent of each other. Critical point. And there is no direct connection between money wages and employment. Funnily enough, the modern theory of inflation is consistent with Keynes's equation. The transmission mechanism of monetary policy is understood as working mainly through demand and mainly through interest rates. This corresponds to E sub D. The key assumption of modern macro is that for the most part the economy is indeed at full employment, in the sense that all observed unemployment usually falls into what Keynes called voluntary and frictional unemployment and is now called the natural rate of unemployment. In terms of the equation, this means that E sub O becomes lower as output rises above its natural rate. And interestingly, Mervyn King does not place much emphasis on EW, the response of money wages to the level of demand. So, on Keynes's reading, what is the explanation of the well-established historical relationship between the quantity of money and the price level? He does not deny that such a relationship exists. His dispute is with the causation, and this debate continues today. Although inflation targeting concentrates more on the policy interest rate than the quantity of money, the idea that too much money causes inflation remains deeply entrenched in mainstream thinking. Now, Keynes points out that this question is a matter for long-run historical generalisation rather than the pure theory of the short period. In other words, it's a matter of the tendencies of the independent variables of the model, which are not amenable to precise equilibrium analysis. Nevertheless, he's prepared to accept that over the long run, and certainly in an era before central banking and inflation targeting, an excess supply of money will tend to drive the interest rate down towards its psychological minimum. Then, through the mechanism that's described by this equation, effectively, falling interest rates will translate into rising effective demand until one of the trigger points is reached, at which the wage unit rises discontinuously, with a corresponding effect on prices. That in turn will reduce the supply of real balances and offset the tendency for interest rates to fall. And Keynes envisages that, in principle, this mechanism could work in reverse, so that a period of high interest rates and low effective demand could lead to discontinuous falls in money wages. But he regards that as unlikely given the nature of wage bargaining. The more likely alternative is that a way will be found, such as the invention of fractional reserve banking, to increase the quantity of money. Thus, as I quote, when money is relatively abundant, the wage unit rises. And when money is relatively scarce, some means is found to increase the effective quantity of money. Unquote. Keynes concludes Book 5, and I must conclude this talk, with a look back to the theme he first developed in chapters 16 and 17, and a look forward to the empirical and policy implications of the general theory which are set out in Book 6. The theme he returns to is the problem that there is a psychological flaw to the rate of interest, which has nothing to do with thrift, but with our fear of what the unknown future may hold. There's no guarantee whatsoever that this rate of interest is a natural or optimum rate that will correspond to full employment. And indeed, the evidence of history suggests quite otherwise. In a rare reference within the general theory to the technical progress and growth of population and land settlements which Marshall sought to capture in his secular period, Keynes notes, he actually used the phrase a little later in chapter 23, but he notes that, quotes, "nothing short of the exuberance of the greatest age of the inducement to investment," that is, the Industrial Revolution, "could have made it possible to lose sight of the theoretical possibility of its insufficiency." Unquote. Once proper allowance is made for the costs of intermediation, taxation, and risk, there may be hardly anything left to tempt holders of wealth to sacrifice their liquidity, as a lending rate low enough to bring about a tolerable level of employment. If this is the case, as Keynes puts it, time-honoured methods of maintaining prosperity may prove unavailing. Which is our cue for the final chapters of the General Theory, Book 6, which we'll address in our final reading group session in 2 weeks' time. Meanwhile, next week we'll hear from Brendan Sheehan on the topic The General Theory and Policies for Global Prosperity, continuing the policy theme that was initiated by Jeff Tiley last week, and hopefully dovetailing with our reading of Keynes's text.